thank you again, Mrs. Grisman, for the first class. And I'm offering the second on the topic of 12 failed. That's all right. 12 failed, 2 succeeded, a lesson in trust. When I sent out the topic originally, I immediately had a couple of emails from people saying, don't you mean 10 failed and 2 succeeded? And the answer is, that's why I put that in the title. Because that's not what I'm not contrasting Yoshua and Kalev on the one hand, and the other spies on the other. Rather, I'm contrasting two separate sets of spies, two separate missions which occurred. We're familiar with, unfortunately, what happens in this coming week's parsha, the failure of the initial Meraglim trip, the spies who are sent by Moshe, the 12, but I wanted to contrast it with the story of the two Meraglim. The truth is, there's another story of Meraglim which completely gets skipped, because that gets like one pasuk in Parshas Chukas, so people aren't even aware of it. It's there and gone. If you want to look it up, it's Bamidbar Perek Chafal of Pasuk Lamed Beis, 21:32, in which we find out that they sent spies, Leragel at Yazer, to spy out to this place called Yazer, which they ended up going to war with, and it seems to have been a successful trip. We won the war, and there's no big story associated with it. But the one I want to focus on is Yoshua's set of Meraglim. Take a look, please, on your sheets. Everybody have? Okay, are there any left on the table there by the entrance? Okay, so there are some over there. This is from the second perek in Yehoshua. Just to frame it in terms of context, the Jews have not yet crossed the Yarden. They have not yet crossed the Jordan. Yehoshua took over after the 30 days of mourning for Moshe, and Yehoshua sent spies into Jericho, into the city of Jericho. That's the first city they're going to encounter once they cross the Yarden. And he gives them a particular mission. If you take a look at source number one, Vayishlach Yehoshua ben Nun min Hashitim, Shnayim Anashim Meraglim. Yehoshua sent from this place called Shittim. That is an infamous place in our history. That was the place where the Jewish men strayed after the daughters of Moab that ended in a terrible plague. So from there, Yehoshua sends two men, Meraglim, spies, cheresh, meaning in secret, silently. Lemur is saying, Lechu re'u es ha'aretz ba'es Yericho. Go see the land, go see Yericho. And then we get this whole story. They come to the house of one by the name of Rachav. They are found out by the king's agents, and the king sends his men in, and Rachav hides them and gives them a strategy to get away. They agree that they're going to save Rachav's family. And then we get to the end of the story when they come back to the nation. Vayashuvu shneha anashim vayirdu mehahar. The 10 men returned. They came out of the mountain. They have been hiding in the mountains from the king's agents who were searching for them. Vayavru, they crossed the Yarden. Vayavo el Yehoshua ben Nun, and they came to Yehoshua. Vayisavru lo es kol hamotzaos osam, and they told Yehoshua everything that had happened to them. Vayamru el Yehoshua, and they said to Yehoshua, Hinasan Hashem biyadenu es kol haaretz. God has given us the entire land, the Gamna Mogu, Kol Yoshvei Ha'aretz Mipaneinu, and everybody is melting away from before us. They're telling Yehoshua what they heard from Rachav, first of all, because Rachav told them that, about the state of morale in Yericho. And they also have gleaned that just from the very fact that the king had agents there looking out for them, and they reacted in such a panic, sending men out on a 3-day trip to see if they can find these Hebrew spies. That clearly tells you that people are scared. So Yeshua sends them a raglan. But I'm less concerned with what happened with these spies than I am with Yehoshua's decision to send them in the first place. You're taking over for Moshe, right? You're already stuck. You're already 10 steps behind if you're taking over for Moshe, right? Moshe is only the person who brought them the Torah. He's only the one who took them out of Mitzrayim. He's only the one with the makos and the man and 100 other miracles along the way. He's only the one who, when Hashem said, I'm going to destroy them, put himself on the line and said, then you're going to have to kill me too. And God at that point backed down, right? I mean, when you talk about replacing Moshe, it's a non-starter. You can't do that. But here he is. And his very first act as leader, right? In Perek Aleph, we find him address the nation and talk to Reuven, Gad, and Menashe and say, I hope you're going to honor your deal about coming into the land with us. And they say, we are going to honor it. Then Hashem tells him, don't worry, I'm going to help you. But right after that, his very first act as leader is to send spies, which didn't work for Moshe. Like, couldn't you have started on like a lower difficulty level and then kind of worked your way up? What in the world is he thinking when he sends these meraglim? Or more to the point, if he thinks this is necessary, if he thinks we need meraglim to go into Yericho, what steps does he take to make sure that what happened 40 years ago isn't going to be replayed? That they're not going to walk into the same trap that they walked into the first time round. So there are a few changes. Do you notice anything even in the psukim themselves about what he did that was different?
Two. He only sent two.
Good. He only sent two. We're going to come back to why he only sends two, but that's a highlight for sure. Two instead of 12. Yes. Sends them quietly, right? The first time round, it's this big broadcast thing. The entire nation knows we're sending your Nisim. This time, a little quieter. Lower profile, yeah. They're not named. Why does that matter? You're right, but why does it matter?
Nobody can pick on them.
In other words, it's not just that they're not named for us. They're not named for the nation either. The people don't know who is sent. More on that in a moment. Tell them.
Are they not, the first ones, are they not called, they're not called directly?
Right. What are they called?
Latur
et Haaretz, or Min HaTarim et Haaretz. They are Tarim, not in the sense of being tourists. That's not quite what we're trying to convey. But Malbim picks up on that distinction, and we'll see that Malbim notes that difference and says there is a substantive difference in terms of their missions reflected in the word that is used, whether they are Tarim or they are Meraglim. So we have a whole bunch of suggestions. The truth of the matter is that there are different views in the classic commentators to this text who try to figure out what Yehoshua did differently. So one view is that these spies are actually none other than Pinchas and Kalev, which is really like top of the line. You can't get any better. Kalev in the sense that he is the one from that first group who didn't stray. Yehoshua can't send himself. That's just a bad idea. Right? We remember what happened when Moshe left the Jews for a few weeks to go up Har Sinai. That didn't work out well either. So Yehoshua is going to stay with the nation. Good move. But Yehoshua sends Kalev, who has already proven that he can do this. And Pinchas, who better than Pinchas? Pinchas is the one who stood up when everybody else was doing something terrible in this place of Shittim, in fact. And he demonstrated he would not go along with the masses. So, okay, you pick two spies who have a good pedigree. How do we know they're Pinchas and Kalev? Is a story for another time. But that's number one. Radak picks up on the Cheresh issue, on the fact that it's silent. He says, it's so silent, the Jews don't know. Meaning, Yehoshua sends them and figures, if it comes out well, then I'll tell everybody, we have this great report from the spies we sent. If they come back with a bad report, I hush it up, right? It's what we call in today's day and age, plausible deniability, right? I don't know what you're talking. I can neither confirm nor deny that there were any spies sent. The Radak, who's not in today's day and age, Radak you're talking about, I think, 13th century, but he says you keep a mission secret and you'll only tell people if the results are good. Okay. Abarbanel takes another view. I think within Abarbanel's view, you have to assume it's not Kalev and Pinchas, because Abarbanel says actually the downfall of the first group was that you sent Nisi'im, that you sent the heads of the tribes. The heads of the tribes have credibility, right? If my Nasi, I'm from Zvulun, and my Nasi comes back and says, this is terrible, we can't make it into the land, I'm going to listen. As far as Abarbanel is concerned, the people he sends are no names. And that way, they will only have as much credibility as Yehoshua chooses to give them. So he's ready for failure. He's ready for this not to work out, and he's going to do it in secret, not tell anybody. He's going to pick people who he can easily discount, and that way, it'll be okay. Malbim, though, says something else that I really want to zero in on. Sorry? Malbim says something else I want to zero in source number two. He picks on this Tarim versus Meraglim distinction that Tova pointed out. He says, Yesh bazeh shnei minei shlichus. He says there are two types of missions. Im ha'am sholchim Tarim, le'ra'os ha'tova imra'a. If the nation sends Tarim to see, is the land good or bad? And in brackets we add, shakhavana bazeh imra'ui shelchamu aleha imlav, meaning to see, is it worth fighting for or not? Is this land good? Is it not good? Should we enter? Should we not enter? In that case, yishlich l'nasi mikol shevet. It makes sense to send a nasi from every tribe. Why? Because they're not going to rely on lesser people. Meaning, I want someone to tell me, is this land worth fighting for or not? I don't want it to be my neighbor. I want it to be the Nasi. But number two, v'lo yismachu shevet al shaliach shevet acher. No one's going to rely on the emissary of another tribe. We're a seafaring tribe. Our interests are by the shore. I'm not interested in what someone who wants to farm cares about, and vice versa. So therefore, I don't trust that he's going to say what I need to hear. I want my Nasi to go. Each one's going to send the one he's going to trust. He'll see, is this land good for my tribe? Vasakavim, what we do? According to who he is, Oved Adama, a farmer, Roetzon, a shepherd, Osek b'mischar, involved in business, Lachof Aniyot, if he goes to see. Lo Chenim Shochim Meragel. Meragel is different, says the Malbim. He says, if they agree to conquer the land already, and they just want to see how best to get in, how best they can conquer the land, then yishlechu ish achad of shnayim mehamonam. You just send one or two people from the general population, kizeh yishlach rak sarat tzava, and then you send a military officer. Right? Someone who can give you a military answer. In other words, this first mission is really, in some sense, a diplomatic mission. You have to convince the nation. So you send your diplomats. You send the Nisiim. The second mission, or third as we noted technically, is an espionage mission. You send spies. You don't send your politicians. So Malbim says the difference between Ragel and Tar is that the first mission that was sent, these Tarim, it's very funny because we use the term Raglim for them all the time. We call them the Maraglim. We should call them the Tarim. That's okay. That's not the first time we find something that gets a name in the Torah and people stick with it even though it's not actually what it's called, right? The Ten Commandments in Hebrew are the? No, that's not what the Torah calls them. Correct. The Torah calls them Aseret HaDevarim. You'll never hear anybody say that, though. Everyone says, Aseret HaDevarim. There are other words like that. That's the way it goes. So the Malbim says the first ones are Tarim, and that means, do we want to go in or not? The second ones are Meraglim. How do we want to go in? What's the best route? Okay, an interesting point, but that's actually not my focus within Malbim. I want to pick up on one phrase within what the Malbim said. He said they won't trust each other. Each Shevet will not trust the other. You know why you need 12? Because each one has to have his own. You see evidence for it, by the way, in figuring out which 12 tribes actually sent Meraglim. Right? Think about it. How many Shvatim are there? 13 Shvatim. Right? Because you have 12 sons of Yaakov, yes. However, Yosef gets split into Ephraim and Menasheh, who are calculated like the other Shvatim. Ephraim and Menasheh, Kruvim and Shimon Yuli, they're like the others. Dina is not a Shevet. But but of the rest of them, whom we know about, you actually have 13 Shvatim. So how do you get only 12 spies? Levi doesn't have. What doesn't Levi have? They don't get land. Why does that matter? Because that's what they're there for. They're there to see what the land is like. So Levi doesn't need, and Ephraim and Manasseh do. That's how you get 12. It's all about seeing what the land is like. Yes? The other possibility is that Levi's not fighting, but I don't know why I would assume that they're not fighting.
They don't get counted.
They aren't counted when they do the count of the military. They're counted separately. It's an interesting point. I don't know whether they did not fight at all in the wars. I don't remember any indication one way or the other. I don't know. It's a good question. Are they really exempt from battle? I can see the argument. Sorry?
The only time they took their swords was against their brothers.
Yeah, that was another story. The Agel. After the Agel, they fought. This is true.
Inside, it wasn't outside.
Correct. So here you have a lack of trust between the tribes that results in each Shevet needing to send its own. But lack of trust is not new with this story in Jewish history. Right? Lack of trust between our tribes is as old as there are tribes. Why did the brothers sell Yosef?
Jealousy?
Could be. You what? He told their father about what they were doing that he felt was bad. Fundamentally, why did they sell him? I mean, these are all bad things, don't get me wrong. But they had a reason to sell him. Elaine?
We would get their inheritance.
They thought he was going to get the inheritance. I'll say it's stronger. They thought that this is the way it's done in the Jewish nation. Two sons, Avram and Sarah, Yitzchak and Yishmael, right? Yitzchak gets the Yerusha, gets the inheritance, and Yishmael is gone. So you're saying, well, that's different because Yishmael's mother was Hagar. Fine. Yitzchak and Rivka have two sons, Yaakov and Esav. Yaakov gets the bracha, and he is going to be the heir, and Esav, Har Seir. Esav gets Har Seir. They look at it and say, we better do something before he does that to us. Right? He thinks he's going to be the next Yaakov, the next Yitzchak. We'd better make sure that we turn him into the next Yishmael, the next Esav, and that way we will be the ones who will inherit. And everything else that goes on, him telling their father the bad things that they're doing, and his dreams, and everything else, and the jealousy about special treatment, he gets a special coat, right? All of that just feeds into this fear that what's happened in the previous two generations is going to happen to us as well. There's no trust from the very beginning in terms of the identity of the Shvatim, of the tribes. It could be that it grows even in Mitzrayim, right? In Egypt, with this fear and mistrust that comes when you're impoverished and persecuted. But certainly we see it when they build the Mishkan. Moshe needs to give an account of everything he collected, right, in Parshas Pekudei. He has to give an account of everything he collected and what it was used for, right? There's a whole discussion in the Medrash about how they collected the funds and what they did to ensure that no one could have any suspicion. What are you suspecting Moshe for? Are you serious? Yes, they are serious, because there's a fundamental problem, a fundamental lack of trust within the nation, and perhaps the persistence of this trait is a casualty of having a system which sets up separate shvatim. Right? Meaning, did you really need to say, you're Reuven, you're Shimon, you're Levi? Levi is unique, because Levi ends up replacing the Bechorim as the ones who work in the Mishkan. So maybe Levi needs to stand alone. But did you really need to identify different traits and different flags and different places where you're going to camp and different parts of the land for the Shvatim? Clearly the answer is yes, because otherwise God wouldn't have done it. But it comes with a price. Right? Even when they go through the Yam Suf, right? They go through the sea. So the Medrash tells us, based on nuances in the Psukim, that each tribe goes through its own channel through the water. Like, what'd you do that for? This was a great national trip. And again, the answer must be that having separate Shvatim serves a purpose. It teaches us lessons. Maybe it's lessons about the diversity of the Jewish people. Maybe it's because you can't have everybody associate with one big nation because it's just too large. They need to have their own group and not feel like they're lost in the mass. I don't know. But I think this may be a byproduct. Once you tell people you're part of this team, then there's trust, or lack of trust, I should say, for the other teams. So we have a record of not trusting each other, and to my mind, that inability to trust, that Malbim sort of just notes along the way to explain why there were 12 and why they were Nisim, I think actually is fundamental in the failure of the mission of that first group, which I'm going to call Meraglim also, because everybody does, even though Malbim says they are Tarim. In general society, trust in human beings is a mixed bag, right? It's hard to make ourselves vulnerable and trust others, right? If we had a lot of time for this year, I would make that a discussion. Why is it hard to trust and so on? But I'm going to take it as having been said that we get burned when we trust other people, right? You put your trust in somebody and then it doesn't work out. They don't do what you relied on them to do. The results can be minor. The results can be catastrophic. But ultimately, we've learned a lesson that we're not going to trust them to take care of something, and eventually get burned enough times, you say, you know what? I'll take care of things myself. I don't need to rely on others. In part, it's because we recognize our own imperfections. I brought you in source number 3, a fascinating piece, for Moshe Tzvi Wexler, the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivot Bnei Akiva in Bnei Brak. And the article is called Emun Bizulat. You can find it online. Emun Bizulat, Trusting Others, in which he says, and in the interest of time, I'm just going to go with the English. He says, the ability to trust others is first and foremost not dependent upon what the other does or fails to do, says or fails to say. It's not about the other person. It's in one's own values. The ability to trust other people springs from the trait of truth in that person. When one acts with righteousness and trustworthiness, not trying to take advantage, I learned a new Hebrew word for me when I did this. The word that's in quotes, if you look at the Hebrew, metachmen. I didn't know that word. The metachmen is to try to take advantage of other people, to pull shtick. So that's metachmen. Good word. Or not a good word, however you look at it. But the point is, when one doesn't try to take advantage of others, one doesn't do things to fool other people, then he also doesn't suspect that other people likewise are going to act with trickery or afflicted with a lack of righteousness. In other words, sometimes it's hard for us to trust because we imagine ourselves in that person's situation and we recognize how hard the challenge is of being trustworthy. So maybe that's another reason why people don't trust. The problem is that society needs trust. I brought you three short pieces from different publications by Francis Fukuyama. He was a major writer on this issue of trust. One of his, in fact, I think a key book of his is the one I quoted, number 6, called Trust, The Social Virtues and the Creation of Prosperity. The other two pieces are from articles of his. But he says in numbers 4, 5, and 6, and I'm not going to read it aloud, but you can see the full quote there, but he says that in nations' well-being, in terms of competing economically, in terms of forming organizations, and in terms of being effective as a nation, relies on trust between citizens. When you have trust between citizens, your economy will thrive, your military will thrive, and your nation will function well. When people don't think that their neighbor has their back, society falls apart. His point is trust as social capital being more important than what people usually think of as the way that societies function. So we need it, but it's really difficult to have it. In the Torah as well, trust is complicated. It's hard for us to trust. And the Torah even speaks negatively about trusting others. Right? I brought you source number 7 as one classic. I am assuming someone's going to say at some point, Al tiftechu mendivim. We're going to come back to that one as well. But take a look at source number 7. Ko amar Hashem, so declares God. Arur hagever asher yivtach ba'adam v'sam basar zero'o min Hashem yasur libo. Cursed is the man who trusts in people. Right? Placing basar, flesh, as his strength, umin Hashem yasur libo, his heart strays from God. And then the more familiar pasuk, Baruch HaGever, Sheiftach Hashem, etc. Hashem Yiftacho, blessed is those who trust in God, Hashem will be trustworthy for him, and so on. We are actually criticized when we put our trust in human beings. It doesn't say why. Right? It just says, don't do it. Don't put your trust in human beings. There's a great passage in the Gemara in Yavama, source number 8. It's actually part of a series of quotes from a book called Ben Sira. Ben Sira is this kind of on-again, off-again person in the Gemara, in the sense that sometimes his work is considered at best worthless and at worst heretical, and then sometimes his work is actually quoted in the Gemara, and the Gemara answers that and says, yeah, because some of the things he said were worth quoting and some of the things he said were not. But there's a whole backstory to who Ben Sira is that we're not going to get into right now, just that the Gemara quotes among its good things that Ben Sira said the following line, keep the multitudes from your home. Don't bring everybody into your house. Many should be those who seek your welfare. Meaning you should have many people who you're just sort of generally friends with. Hi, how are you? I'm fine. How are you? But only tell your secrets to 1 in 1,000. Have a lot of people who are general friends, but your best friends, 1 in 1,000. You shouldn't be so trusting of others. Rabbeinu Bachya, in source number 9, in Chovos HaLevavos, goes through 7 different reasons why you would trust somebody. They have your best interests at heart, they have the ability to help you, and so on. And he says, all 7 of those are found in God, they're not found in human beings. He doesn't believe in trusting human beings. So here we are, being told that we should only trust Hashem. And it's underscored by warnings that we get about trusting people for reasons both religious and practical. Right? Al tiftechu ben divim, the pasuk I mentioned before, the pasuk in Tehillim, which is part of the davening every morning. Right? Al tiftechu ben divim ben adam shein lo teshua. Do not trust princes. Do not trust human beings because they can't save you. Teitzei rucho yeshuva ad mato. People are limited. They are mortal. There comes a time when they pass on. They're not going to be. They're too limited to help you. So at best, even with good intentions, human beings can't help you. And at worst, because people are bad. The Gemara at the end of Sota talks about the generation when Mashiach will come, and it speaks of it. I brought you in source number 10. Chutzpah Yaski. It will be a time of chutzpah. I didn't translate chutzpah. I felt like translations just don't do it justice. The brazenness or some such thing. But Oyve Ish Anshe Beso. A person's enemies will be the people in his own household. Pnei Ador Ki Pnei Akelev. The generation's face will be that of a dog. Haben Eino Misbayesh Be'aviv. Children will not be embarrassed before their parents. On whom can we rely? Alavinu Shabashamayim. Hashem is the only one we can rely on. Or take a look at source number 11, the last source I'll bring to drum this home, is this great source from Maseches Derech Eretz, Perek Ben Azai. Or Pirkei Ben Azai Perek Gimel. Maseches Derech Eretz is one of the many Masechtos. We are familiar with the general Masechtos of Shas, the general tractates, right? Brachos, Shabbos, Erevim, Sachem, Shkalim, and so on. But there are many Masechtos, miniature ones, that actually have a lot to say on very relevant points, and they are usually published at the end of Gemara Avodah Zarah. So this is one of them, Maseches Derech Eretz. And we're told here, La'olam yiyu kol b'nei adam be'inecha kilistim. All people should be as bandits in your eyes, that they mechabdan ki Rabban Gamliel, and you should honor them like Rabban Gamliel. Meaning, treat them with the greatest honor. Rabbi Gamliel is the Nasi, the leader of the Jews. You should assume the worst and trust him like he's the greatest. This is also known in the short form as a two-word Hebrew phrase. Kavdeyu vechashdehu. That's exactly right. Honor him and suspect him. There are other sources we could bring. It sounds much better in the Hebrew, doesn't it? Kavdei v'chashdei is so much better. So the point is that here Turchiner is talking about the importance of trust, and society needs trust, and people don't trust, but they should. And in the meantime, we have source after source that say, trust in Hashem, not in human beings. So not only that, yeah?
Doesn't it say in the first Animan that everything that happens is from Hashem anyway? So you think that everything is from Hashem, so...
Right. So if you are to say, well, since everything is from God anyway, what do you lose? Trust him, don't trust him, it isn't going to change anything anyway, just trust in Hashem. So one answer I could give would be that by trusting, that reduces your reliance on Hashem, and maybe that's one of the concerns. It'll make the person daven less and draw further from Hashem. But I think also because we have this general principle, like the Gemara says, "Ein sumchan al hanes," we don't rely on miracles. We are meant to function in the world as though what we are doing is what makes or breaks things. And then the degree to which Hashem, through Hashgacha Pratis, is going to supervise what happens is subject to great debate among the Chachamim and the Gemara and later on. Is it every blade of grass grows only because a Malach tells it to grow? Or there are other views in the Gemara and in the later authorities who are less specific about the way in which Hashem runs it. That he runs it is not the question. The question of how he runs it and the degree of supervision is the question. Yes?
There is a point at which you do have to trust people. I mean, as was said earlier about the economic value of trust, you can't do business if you cannot take people at their word. Mm-hmm. You can't, you know, like, okay, you can't practice law without being able to believe another lawyer when they say, lawyers, when they talk in court, are assumed to be telling 100% the truth, even though you're not sworn, there's no affidavit, nothing signed. If you say something, it's believed as being the truth. It's a responsibility
right.
to tell the truth. So if you aren't going to believe that other people are telling the truth, you're at a standstill. You can't work.
Right. From a practical perspective, you have to, but not just that. The Mishnah and the Gemara itself tell us that we have to trust. Mishnah and Pirkei Avos, I didn't put it on the sheet because I think you're familiar with it. Have a danas kol ha'adam l'kav zechus. You have to judge everybody favorably. Granted that that doesn't apply where you have reason to doubt them. Make that clear. We have reason to suspect that they're lying. You don't say, "Don't look at us," and I'm going to close my eyes. But that already tells you we have a bias towards trusting. But let's say it even stronger. Moshe says to Hashem, when Hashem charges Moshe with leading the Jews, and he says, "Go tell them that Hashem is going to take you out," Moshe's response is, "Hein lo yaminu li." They're not going to believe me. Right? He gets in big trouble for that. Take a look at the Gemara in source number 12. Hachoshed b'ksherim loke begufo. One who suspects the righteous will suffer bodily harm. Because Moshe says, v'heim lo yaminuli, they're not going to trust me. And Hashem says, you better believe they're going to trust you. He says, they are ma'aminim b'nei ma'aminim. That's not just a song, it's a Gemara. They are believers. They are the children of believers. And then the Gemara explains what we mean by that. They are believers because the Pasuk says, Vayamein Ha'am, when Moshe brought in the reports, they did believe. And they are the children of believers because Hashem promises Abraham a future and Behemin Bashem. He trusted Hashem. Granted, he also said, Bamoyedaki Irashena, that's another shir. But it said, Behemin Bashem, Abraham trusted God. And Hashem says to Moshe, not only that, Atai in Sof Chala Ha'amin, you're going to be the one who won't believe. At the rock, when Moshe gets punished for hitting the rock, Hashem says, Yan lo ha'eman tembi. Because you had a failure of trust. Whatever that means for Moshe. And how do we know he got zapped for it? How do we know he got hurt? Because Hashem says to him, put your hand in your jacket, right? And he takes his hand out, and it is saras. Why saras? Because he spoke Lashon Hara about the Jews. He said, hey, lo ya'aminuli, that they're not going to believe. Hashem says, you don't do that. You're Hoshed B'ksherim, you're suspecting the righteous, and he says such a person is Loke, gets lashed, gets struck. That's the case with Moshe, but not only with Moshe. We have it as well in another story a little later on in Tanakh, the story of Chana. Right, you remember the story? Chana is davening for a child. She's pouring out her heart. Raks fasana os. Right, her lips are moving. Kolola yishama. Her voice is not heard. Eli the Kohen Gadol sees her and Ba'achshebel ashikora. He thought that she was drunk, and on that basis he rebukes her. And then after he finds out, she tells him, "No, that's not my problem." After she explains what's going on, source number 13, Vayan Eli Vayomer Lachila Shalom. Eli says to her, go to peace, go to completeness, go to peace. He's giving her a bracha. Says Rabbi Elazar, Mikan Lachoshid es Chavero Bedavar She'ein Bo Shetzarich Lafaiso. We see from here that if you suspect someone falsely, you have to go after that person and satisfy that person, appease that person. You've wronged the person. You can't just say, well, it was a mistake. You have to make it up to the person. And then, not only that, Sarich Levarcho, you have to give that person a bracha, because it continues to say, not only did he say, L'chila Shalom, but he said, Elokei Yisrael Yitena She'laseich, may God give you that which you are asking for. He gave her a bracha. You suspect someone falsely, you have to give them a bracha. So now I have a problem. You told me, don't trust, don't trust, don't trust. Only put your trust in Hashem. And in the meantime, don the kavzachus. And if you suspect people falsely, oh, are you in trouble? What are we to make of this? And it's not just that. It's in institutional situations. We're told in Devarim, the 18th parak of the 18th chapter of Devarim, the Navi comes to you. You have to trust the Navi. Unless the Navi says to do something that's against what Moshe said, you're supposed to trust the prophets who come to you. The Lo Sasur, you're not supposed to stray from the words of the Chachamim. You're supposed to follow what they say. They tell you right is left is right. You're supposed to follow them. That's emunah. That's trust in human beings. And not only that, we have an obligation to trust general people. Source number 14, this goes back to Mrs. Witte's point. The Rambam writes in the Laws of the Sanhedrin, if two people come to you, this is not dealing with lawyers, this is dealing with the parties who come to a case, how the judge looks at the two litigants. Even though we have a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos that says that you should look at both sides as equally wicked before the beforehand and righteous afterwards, nonetheless, the Rambam writes, it's based on a Gemara, if two litigants come to you, echad kasher v'echad rasha, one of them is known to be a good guy, one of them always follows the law, the other one is known not to follow the law, don't say, since this guy is known to be wicked, he is known to be a liar, and this other one is known to be someone who speaks the truth, I am going to turn the judgment against the wicked one. That's what the Rambam says. Says the Minchas Chinuch, I don't understand what you're talking about. Of course you can't warp the judgment. Of course you can't turn the judgment against him. Why would I? Even if he's a bad guy, you have to hear everybody out. What are you talking about? So the Minchas Chinuch, Rabbi Yosef Abad, in source number 15, says that's not what it's saying. What it's saying, rather, what the Rambam is trying to tell you, is that you can't assume that the wicked one is a liar during the judgment. You have to treat them the same. I might have thought, you know this guy, he has a track record. No. You always have to assume truth in the court. So now I'm just completely lost, right? Again, where have we been? We started out by saying that one of the things that Yehoshua seeks to change is he puts it from 12 to 2. And we said the reason why there were 12, according to the Malbim, is because the tribes don't trust each other. And we said that that's terrible because you need trust. We have a history of not trusting each other among the Shvatim. However, we need to be able to trust each other. It's necessary for society. What are we supposed to do? And we said that on the one hand, the Jew is told not to trust, and then on the other hand, now we're finding out that no, actually, you're not supposed to suspect people falsely, you're supposed to trust them institutionally. So now I have a mess. So what I'd like to contend in the next couple of minutes is that trust is not only a practical currency, like what Fukuyama is saying, you know, is what you trade with each other. Trust is also about a personality. Yeah, if you go back to the Gemara in Shabbos that I showed you on the previous page, in source number 12, the Jews are named Ma'aminim b'nei Ma'aminim. We are those who trust. There's a difference between being a Ma'amin and being one who is Ma'amin. There's difference between trusting someone and being a trusting person. And I think what's going on is that we are identified as ma'aminim, as people whose default is to trust. That's who we are as our personality trait. We are supposed to be trusting people. Now, that can be bad if it's played out into action in the wrong way. On a theological level, right, trusting human beings can be a negative. Our trust should be in God. And on a practical level, if we employ that trust, we can get burned when we trust human beings who we should not trust. But on a personal level, as human beings, we have to be ma'aminim. A person who is afraid to trust, who is, as called in Hebrew, a chashdan, a person who always suspects others, is afraid, he spends his whole life looking for negatives in other people, looking for ways to justify not trusting them. The person who's afraid will justify his own impropriety, saying, well, everybody's doing it, because that's what he really genuinely believes. A person who's afraid to trust may even lack the ability to trust himself, to trust herself. Right? It all goes as a package. The trait of not being a trusting person has terrible ramifications. And the need to be a trusting person is not only because of the impact it has on our relationships with others, but also what it does to our relationship with Hashem. Because it's not an on-off. You can't say, when it comes to human beings, I'm not a trusting person. When it comes to God, I am a trusting person. The two are intertwined. The Maharal says something beautiful. Take a look at source number 16, please. In his Netiv HaEmunah, the beginning, where he's discussing what faith is, and what is faith if not trust after all, he quotes you the pasuk in Mishlei, which he gives his own spin. The pasuk, as brought in the Hebrew, Rav Adam Yikra Ish Chazdo V'Ish Emunim Miyimtza, which he translates as, there are many people who are known for their chesed, who are known as Ish Chazdo, but who can find a man of trust? And what he explains in that is the following. Shlomo HaMelech, credited with Mishlei, says there are many people who are called a person of chesed. But can you really find a person of trust? And he says, whether regarding trust in Hashem, in which he must believe with complete belief, or regarding trust in that he must be trustworthy in all of his affairs and conduct, meaning, what the Maharal is doing, is he's linking trust in Hashem with being trustworthy in your actions. If you want to be called a person of trust, an Ish Emunah, you have to be trustworthy in your relationships with others, and you have to trust Hashem. The two go hand in hand. You can't separate one from the other. And this was said more strongly in a very interesting article by a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Shlomo Vilk, source number 17, Rosh Yeshivat Machanayim in Efrat. He said something remarkable. His whole article is a very interesting article. But he talks about taking a trip to the Far East, and how there, that which stood out for him in Western society suddenly was accepted as normal. Things like he wouldn't eat the food that they had. He wouldn't eat their food. He said, "You know what? I'm going to eat food that has that conforms with standards of kashrus." He's going to eat kosher food, and he said that in certain elements of Western society, that's looked at as strange. What's the difference? Our food, your food. What does it matter? But there, people who grow up with an element of what he calls being simple, not being simplistic, but being simple and just being open and trusting, they recognize the possibility that, you know what, maybe there's something to this. This idea that God told me that I should eat this food and not eat that food. Or as he brings here in source number 17, he says, we, the people with him, discovered that trusting people and simple, not simplistic thought, without fear or harshness, produces people who are heaven-revering and God-serving. In Tel Aviv, he claims, tefillin appear unusual and anachronistic. I don't accept that, but that's what he says. Specifically there in the East, tefillin appeared entirely natural. They were fine with it. Leaving aside the Tel Aviv comment. But his general point is that people who are more trusting of human beings will be more likely to trust in God. They'll be more likely to accept.
And yeah. Trust in human beings, or is it in actions, traditions, what human beings do? I don't know how tefillin and eating kosher necessarily corresponds to trusting that a person is on it.
Right. I don't think he's taking that leap. I think you're right. I think what he's trying to say is that people who are naturally trusting of other human beings are accepting of the idea that there's something from Hashem as well.
Okay.
That's what I think he's doing. Yeah.
It seems like he's trying to say people who are trusting, meaning they're accepting of your differences. They're more tolerant.
That's certainly a piece of it. Right. I don't think that he actually makes the step to tolerance exactly, except as a function of trust, perhaps. I just, yeah.
The trusting that the person is different isn't harmful.
Right.
People don't trust.
I hear that.
Right.
I hear that. I want to make sure to add one more note to this, though. I hear what you're saying. I think it's an outgrowth, perhaps, of where he is. But what we're saying here is that we're labeled ma'aminim b'nei ma'aminim, people who trust, regarding our trust in Hashem and regarding our trust in human beings. And even if there are times when we can't put the trust in human beings, nonetheless, the default has to be this is who we are. And then I'm forced in this situation not to deploy my core identity of trust. That's what happened the first time around. They didn't have that character, and it resulted in disaster. And I think that fundamentally you can link the Shvatim, the tribes, and their inability to trust each other with their inability to trust in Hashem as well, because that's what brings down the mission, right? They come back and they say, "Misinas Hashem osanu hotzionu me'aretz Mitzrayim." God hates us. That's why He took us out of Egypt. It's a complete breakdown of any level of trust. But Yoshua felt his generation was ready, and he said, "You know what? I'm going to send two. And when they come back, if it's a good report, I'm going to tell everybody I sent only two. And they're going to be okay with that." That's what Yoshua believes is going to work out. One last note on this lesson of being a ma'amin. A beautiful idea. If you could take another 30 seconds. I realize that I'm out of time. But take a look at source number 18 from Rabbi Shabtai Sabato, who I imagine is the son of Rabbi Sabato of Malaya Dumim, although I don't know that. But the name is a unique name. But he's the Rosh Hashiva in Mitzpe Yericho, and he says, Moshe describes Hashem in Parshas Ha'azinu as Kel Emunah. Not as Kel Ne'eman, but as Kel Emunah. Why? He says, the word Emunah includes not only being trustworthy, but also being trusting. It's not just that Hashem is trustworthy, Kel Ne'eman, someone we can trust, but He is also trusting in us. Hashem puts that trust in us as well, which I think is a beautiful idea, and hopefully a positive way to end the year's Midrash Yom Rishon programs. I'll stay afterwards for people who have additional questions, and I know that when Mrs. Grisman ended, there was a question for her as well, so hopefully she can also stay for a moment to hear, maybe. But thank you so much for participating. I'm going to send out a follow-up email asking for ideas and feedback on Midrash Yom Rishon. Please make sure you signed in if you did not do so. Thank you very much.